Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Humanism is great, but it just seems to me that it's Christianity's kit with the badge ripped off.
To paraphrase, I think it's Saint Augustine, Lord, make me vegan, but not just yet.
Yeah.
I had to do it because I love a bacon sandwich.
We've had Kant and Wittgenstein and Habermas and all sorts of clever names brought up. Don't go thinking that, stand-up comedians can't debate it with the best of them.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, we're having a laugh on the show today. Two comedians, one a Christian, one an atheist, join me to talk about their views on God, faith and comedy. I'll introduce them in just a moment. And if you enjoy what we're bringing you, you might want to consider supporting us. You can do that from our website, premierunbelievable.com. Check out all the great stuff there. So many podcasts and resources and tons of articles that we're now producing on a weekly basis. You can also register for our newsletter, get a free ebook, lots of ways that you can engage with us. But yeah, if you can support us, it makes a huge difference. By the way, our next live event is coming up soon, Tuesday the 15th of November, Culture War Questions with Sean McDowell. He's such a great speaker and apologist, Sean. He's been a longtime friend of the show, and his most recent book, A Rebel's Manifesto, is aimed at those who want to act with grace and speak with truth on big polarizing issues like LGBT, pornography, abortion, morality. So Sean will be my guest, and you can ask your questions live. It's a live show, Tuesday the 15th of November. You just need to register to be part of it. Do that at unbelievable.live, taking place at 8 p.m. UK. That's 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. Again, Tuesday, 15th of November, unbelievable.live. Free to attend, but registration is essential. You can join from anywhere in the world. Link is with today's show info. We'll have some of your feedback towards the end of today's show as well. Tell you about some exciting shows that I'm recording as well in this coming week. But for now, let's get into today's discussion. Today, we're talking about comedy, atheism, and the search for God. Have you heard the one about the Christian and the atheist who walked into a bar? Well, two stand-up comedians join me today. Andy Kind is a Christian. His new book, Hidden in Plain Sight, Clues You May Have Missed in the Search for Meaning, is a very funny, very accessible, and very concise look at Christian faith amongst all the possible worldviews out there. Another stand-up comedian, also named Andy White, is going to talk with us today about his humanist approach to life, the universe and everything. And along the way, I'm sure we'll hear a few jokes and stories about life on the comedy circuit and where, if at all, faith fits into that. So Andy and Andy, welcome along to the show.
Well met, Justin. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Andy. And hi, Justin.
This is going to be a very confusing show, inevitably. So forgive me if I have to resort to saying Andy White and Andy Kind, or Andy K and Andy W. But
can you change your name to Andy, please, Justin? That way, I think we both feel a lot more comfortable if that happened.
And also, I notice Andy Kind, your caption is Zoom user. So perhaps we should call you that.
That's my birth name. Yeah.
Was your dad David Bowie?
Andy Kind is a stage name. Didn't you know that?
Well, it's
my parents,
great.
Mr. and Mrs. Zoom user, were delighted to welcome you to the world.
Oh. Well, it's great to have you both on. Thank you. I can say I'm going to have trouble controlling this today with two people who like to basically have the limelight joining me on the show. Andy Kind, tell us a little bit about yourself for those who don't know who you are, and about your own sort of career in comedy and where Christian faith came in all of that.
Yeah, sure. So I have been a comedian for nearly 17 years now. And when I started, Andy White was already an established name on the comedy circuit. I got into comedy around the same time as I became a Christian. I became a Christian at the age of 22, having been raised in a Christian home, but largely been ambivalent and apathetic about arguments for and against God. But then I had what you might call an experience of God, born out of, I think, a sense of existential angst. And I'd always wanted to be a comedian. When I became a Christian, I thought, okay, well, maybe this desire I've had burning in me to be a comedian, maybe that's not random. You know, it says in the Bible, God gives us our heart's desires. I don't think that just means that whatever we want, God gives us, but actually God plants in us desires to serve him and serve the world in different ways. So it joined the dots, really, ironically. Becoming a Christian for what sent me into comedy. And I've been doing that, as I say, for 17 years. For the first couple of years, I was just on the comedy circuit as an open spot, and then as a, you know, middle act and growing on the circuit. After the first couple of years, I realized that I wanted to make my career a bit more meaningful and to operate as a sort of resource for churches putting on outreach events. So I started doing some gigs in churches. And that's probably the body of what I do now, alpha launches and community building events. So it's still comedy, as you'd see on the comedy circuit, but it's from a different end game, if you like. So, yeah, that's me. And I wouldn't be a comedian if it wasn't for becoming a Christian, which is not the standard narrative, but that's where we are.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us a bit about your background as well. Andy White, has comedy always been something you've done, sort of from the time you were a boy up till now?
No, sort of. As befits an atheist, my comedy career is a series of random accidents that ultimately mean nothing. No, honestly, I got into comedy because someone put me up to it at work. They said, you seem amusing. Have you thought about doing comedy? And I said, well, I'll give it a go. So, and I think just as a lark, they booked me in to do 5 minutes at a open mic competition at Jongler's Battersea sometime in February the 19th, 1998. And yes, it was so traumatic that the date is seared into my memory in that respect. Looking back, though, I'd always been a bit of a performer or a writer. So creative writing at school was always my favourite subject, and I took part in drama stuff. At uni, I wrote a load of sketches, directed them, put people on to do them, that sort of thing. And also, I think growing up at the time, sort of late 80s, early 90s, when, as the cliche was, that comedy was a new rock and roll. So it was just something in the air. So when I did eventually do a stand-up slot, even though I was terrified, I thought, yeah, I know roughly how this sort of thing is supposed to go. I've seen Ben Elton, Bill Hicks, Friday Night Live, all that sort of stuff. And I went into it, and although it was terrifying and I did all right, it was really exhilarating. And I thought, yeah, I've got to keep doing that. And then a few years later, as Andy Kind said, I was established on the comedy circuit, and 20 years later, I'm currently being, it feels, unestablished or sort of disestablished.
Disenfranchised.
So my career is still burbling on, despite my best efforts at self-sabotage. And
what are these efforts? I'm fascinated by this disestablishment. What's happened?
It's just basically using comedy as a reason to avoid work and sort of treating my life as an extended gap year with payment. This is my picking grapes in the south of France.
Okay,
what I'm doing.
Where has sort of faith figured in that? Has that ever been in the background? Was there a conscious moment you decided you were an atheist? And what you also used the label humanist? Perhaps you could explain that to me.
Yes. Well, I was trying to think about this. When did I realize it? And this is a gradual thing. And the first time I remember publicly saying I was an atheist, I think I was 12 years old at school. And It was in an English lesson. We were discussing this for some reason. And I just said, I meant to say I'm an atheist, but I didn't know the correct word. And I said, I'm an egovist. And then everybody around me, I remember bursting out laughing at me because I got the word wrong. And I was considered to be the swatty one in the class. So they
although
got their
it
revenge.
It becomes itself a very prophecy, doesn't it? Because all comedians are massive egovists.
Yes. So. It's true. I was more true than I realized.
Yeah.
So that's first. So that's the first time I remember sort of saying it. And then later on with the humanism thing, I think what it is, and my wife became a Buddhist and started attending the Birmingham Buddhist Society. And she actually started doing that because of a phobia of dentists, oddly enough. And somebody said, well, why not learn how to do meditation, mindfulness, that sort of thing? And they did that at the Birmingham Buddhist Center. And then she got the vibe for Buddhism and is now ordained into what was the Western Buddhist Order, which is now known as the Tree Ratna Order. So she's got a kesa and a sort of lanyard that she wears on official occasions, and she's got an official Buddhist name. Though me and the family still refer to her by, as we call it, her Muggle name. So I was thinking, well, how do I feel about sort of life and meanings and all that sort of stuff? And my grandfather, when my grandfather died, he wasn't a religious man. And we're thinking, well, what do we do about the funeral? And the funeral director suggested we try a humanist celebrant. So we did that. And I thought, this sounds like an interesting thing to pursue. So I went along to a few sort of humanist meetings. In Birmingham, it was just people chatting about, sort of doing sort of skeptical sort of debunking stuff, the way these things happen. But I thought to myself at the time, well, it's not enough just to say you don't believe in God. What are you going to do with your life now? Mm. And so the way I approach humanism is to say, right, we are what we are. It's just us. The universe is not for us, so we have to be here for us. And yes, we have values, and those values are guided by science and reason, and we update our beliefs depending on what new information we get. That's how I'd encapsulate that.
It's a really helpful encapsulation. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Andy. And Andy Kind, what sort of reception do people of faith or Christians specifically get on the comedy circuit? Is atheism a kind of the default? I mean, that might be what a lot of people assume.
I think it was when I started out in the mid-noughties. And it's interesting, isn't it? Just the way that the zeitgeist has changed and morphed over the last 10 to 15 years, not just within sort of academic apologetics, but just generally as well. Atheism, I don't think, is the default setting for most people now. Obviously, you can only speak from your own experience, but most people I speak to would no longer consider themselves hardcore atheists. Lots of people are still as cynical about, dominionist worldviews as they were in the past. But I think probably we seem to have veered back towards a vaguely spiritual pick and mix worldview. So, there are some entrenched atheists on the comedy circuit. My experience has always been that, there's a camaraderie, particularly post-pandemic, but there's a camaraderie amongst comedians. You know, if Andy White and I are on the same bill, we've got sort of 35 years combined experience, and you don't survive that long unless you're good at what you do. And so I think certainly when I'm gigging with people, whatever their worldview, I primarily see them as a fellow survivor within the trenches of the comedy circuit. And certainly in my early days there were people who wouldn't book me because I was a Christian, And I remember once doing a gig, I was hosting the gig, and it was a bit of a bear pit. It was up in Chester, and I went on and I couldn't control the crowd, and I'm usually quite good at that. And I came off stage, and there was this guy there, a friend of mine, but you know, quite staunch atheist, who said, "Where's your Messiah now?" And you get that sort of playfulness. But really, I think, you know, comedians are just quite self-contained individuals. You turn up in a green room and you're thinking about doing well enough to earn not just the money on the night, but to get rebooked again. So it's only with people, you know, I can count on one hand the number of people who I would chat to about big questions in the green room. And Andy White is certainly one of them. So you don't normally get down to the big questions. And I think certainly given that most people now know that I'm not a sort of didactic, aggressive, religious zealot, and certainly now on the wrong side of 40, I think you do tend to soften and broaden out in your, not necessarily your sort of belief, but in your churchmanship, your theology, your way of dealing with people, which is obviously where Hidden in Plain Sight came from.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about the book in a moment, but do you recognise that, Andy W., you know, that description of the comedy circuit and the way that faith is treated in it?
Well, just like to latch on to what Andy Kind said, I'm more so the wrong side of 40, wrong side of 50, in fact. And I too have softened and broadened in my waistline. But also perhaps in my views, I might have back in the day been a bit more of an edgelord about my atheism. Andy's now looking at me and thinking, Andy, you were never an edgelord.
No. You've always been the cuddliest man on the comedy circuit.
I mean, did you ever do any kind of full-on Ricky Gervais, you know, sort of take down religion type of sequences on stage?
I think I have done in the past that sort of thing, because again, sort of growing up with the sort of comedy I used to watch, I alluded to Bill Hicks and people like that, there'd always be a bit where you have a go at the God botherers, that sort of thing. Whereas nowadays, you know, so through meeting people like Andy and other sort of Christians on the circuit, and also, most recently, I did a gig at the Greenbelt Festival. I got booked for that. I don't know how, but got booked. And I wasn't sure what to expect. But I turned up there the day before and attended all sorts of things, political talks, scientific talks, that sort of thing, with people who were Christian and not Christian, and thought, well, in terms of a lot of the values being expressed here, I can see a lot of common ground. I'm from a vaguely left of center politically, sort of social democratic. And there was a lot of that sort of stuff going on.
Well, you would have been at home at Greenbelt.
So that was lovely. And also before that, having done sort of clean comedy gigs for someone you may know, Andy, Helen Tomlin, who was a youth organiser at the Birmingham Diocese. And she invited me one time to do a gig at their conference for all the Birmingham vicars and that. And I said, you do know what my beliefs are. So I said, oh, it doesn't matter. You're funny. And I had a lovely time there. I must admit, I was sat at the table and I was talking to one guy and says, all right, so what is it you do? And he was a bit vague. And then Helen said, oh, just tell him. He says, well, actually, I'm the Bishop of Birmingham.
I love it.
Okay, you're the guy who's basically paying for this gig. And I don't know who you are. But no, did the thing. And he sent me a very nice letter afterwards.
So I
attended humanist meetings where we talked about the importance of rituals. Even sort of non-religious ones, and you know, I had one or two people say, well, you see, these religious people, they're a bit thick really, aren't they? I said, no, No. I wouldn't say Thomas Aquinas or St. Augustine were dullards.
Yeah.
And even these days, sort of like Rowan Williams.
Mm. Yeah, he's got a brain on him.
He's definitely got a brain on him. Yeah. As speaks several languages. I'm told one of them might be English.
Well, if you're looking, if you feel like a muggle, then Rowan Williams is definitely the Dumbledore of the Christian world.
But he looks like it though as well.
He does. Like, he does. Like, to be fair,
teaching at Hogwarts. Yeah.
And has joined me on many an edition of this show, so do check out that in the archives. Yeah. But this is great. I'm really enjoying hearing some of these stories and anecdotes from the comedy circuit. But Andy, we're here really to talk about your new book, Hidden in Plain Sight. Tell us about the premise of this book and why it is so short.
Yeah, is this a good time, by the way, to show my leather bound decanter?
Please do.
Because I wanted to show it, because it's not fair. You see, Andy White has the advantage of looking clever. He's got, you know, he's got the lovely hair, he's got the glasses, he's got the bookshelf. Whereas I look like the guy who rode a motorbike over your granddad's allotment. So, you know, I've got to sort of balance things up. I've put these things up. These don't belong on this wall. They go in the living room.
So that those pictures of ancient ships behind you don't normally live there. They're just
no, but I needed
for the
something
audience.
Because otherwise it's just a blank wall, and it's the sort of wall you might be executed up against. So I wanted to give some kind of backdrop, and I'll show the decanter later. And
please
any
point
do want.
Bring it in whenever
I can put
you
it
like.
On Instagram, if that's what people are interested in.
It looks beautiful.
So Hidden in Plain Sight, I think, came out of a desire to have proper conversations. I think when I first became a Christian, when I first started in comedy, again, you had these two sort of big opposing forces. On the one hand, you had the new atheists who were saying religion is stupid, religious people are stupid. And now plenty of religious people aren't stupid, so fair enough. But then on the other hand, you had the sort of quite aggressive, you know, maybe fundamentalist Christian apologists saying this is why Christianity is true. Deep down, you know it's true. Deep down, you know you're a sinner. And they were just firing shots at one another without really, you know, the most they were doing was tearing down the other people's arguments. And, you know, I don't think atheism is true, and I do think religious people are stupid. So like, I sort of agree with both. But what I wanted to hear and what I want to try and do in my career as a stand-up, but also as a preacher and a writer, is to tell a good story. And Andy, you mentioned Augustine. Augustine said you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago that preaching should do three things, one of which is delectare, which is to rivet and delight. So even Augustine said that one of the three facets of preaching should be to delight and to rivet. And you do that primarily with stories. I mean, Jesus told stories. And so I wanted to persuade, and I think this is the sort of terminology we're using nowadays. We're no longer trying to talk about convincing, because you can't convince people necessarily if they don't want to, but you can share your story and you can persuade people. And I know from my own life, if someone's trying to give me feedback, it's much more likely to yield a good result if they say, have you thought about this as well, rather than you should do this or you shouldn't have done that. So I wanted to have a conversation because, again, If you go in with an entrenched position, all you're going to do is fire shots and have to hunker down when other people do it. You don't actually get to the good stuff. People's defenses come up and it just becomes this big impasse. And I'm not interested in that. I'm actually completely okay with people disagreeing with me. I disagree with myself on plenty of things and have changed my mind on lots of things. But what I want is to have good conversations and to share good stories. I want to tell good stories. And I believe that the story of Jesus, the story of Christianity, what Tolkien would have called the true myth of Christianity, is simply the best totalizing narrative for what we experience as human beings. And I wanted to do that by building a common ground. Again, that happens with comedy. You don't laugh at something unless you recognize it from your own life. And it's also psychologically impossible to hate someone that you've laughed with. So there's something in that. I wanted to build common ground. And so rather than taking this sort of baby boomer or modernist approach of this is why Christianity is true, this is why you've been wrong all along, whatever, This is why you should live for Christ instead. I wanted to talk about the things that actually the vast majority of people agree on and agree with, what I like to call our little story. And whatever your worldview, you know that you want to be loved. You know that you believe in purpose. You want your life to be about something and to go somewhere. And you know that freedom is better than being trapped. You know that some things are objectively wrong. Now, you and I might disagree on what's right and what's wrong, but that human rights urge, if you like, that sense of justice we all share. We all know what hope and joy feel like. Again, I might hope for different things and find joy in different things, but hope and joy feel the same. It's what Descartes called the sort of the quale, the experience of these inner, you know, things like joy and hope. They feel the same. So that's our little story. There's other things as well. So, you know, death feels unnatural. And when we listen to beautiful music, it takes us out of ourselves towards something else. I want to say, okay, well, that's the little story. Is there then a big story that makes sense of that? So in the book, Hidden in Plain Sight, I look at the big stories that put a claim on our identity and hopefully in a humble and gentle way, walk through them and land at that small hill in first century Palestine, where X marks the spot, and say, look, I think in spite of everything wrong with Christianity and religion, and in spite of all the good stuff that's going on in these other worldviews, I still think that Christianity, the story of Jesus, makes the most sense. And it's not a knockdown, you know, end run touchdown, but makes the most sense of what we know about ourselves, that the big story of Christianity fits our little story better than any of the other competing worldviews. And it's so short because no one wants to read long books, Justin.
I was about to say, I'm holding it up for camera here, actually. It's only that thick. You could get through that in an hour or two, okay, quite easily. And actually, I think we need more short books. Oh, look, and Andy W is holding up his copy as well. Anyway, so I can recommend it because it's a good... The problem is with the average apologetics book, if you give it to a non-Christian, you're basically asking them to spend about 2 days of their life
reading something quite hardcore.
You know,
I've just finished reading Reasonable Faith by William Lane Craig. I started it in 2009. That's how long it's been taking. So, yeah, I think because I've written a book that I want Christians to share with people who are not Christians. And the way I wanted to do that was to make it funny, but also short, to give people at least a chance of getting to the end. So
Well, you've shared it with a non-Christian, namely Andy White. So were you persuaded in any way, Andy White?
Well, I did like the bit where you were talking about that we do want things, hope and justice, and we love beauty. And also the idea, the thing that Sehnsucht, you were talking about, that the longing. And I have recognised that in myself, those sort of longings for things to be better, or longing for a location for a particular feeling I have. And I remember reading about this other something C.S. Lewis wrote. I wondered if that had been an influence on you, talking about, I think it was in his book, The Four Loves, or it might have been in Pilgrim's Regress, which I've read, where it talks about this love for the natural world, but at the same time realizing that the natural world isn't enough to satisfy that. And I recognize that feeling in myself. And what you say is that feeling is implanted in you by God, and it wouldn't be there unless there was something out there that reciprocated that, that use the image of the symbol, isn't it? So a symbol originally some sort of clay tablet, and you break it in half.
Yeah, the symbol, and that's right.
The symbol, and then your half fitted the half of the other person, in jigsaw pieces, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, yes, I like the idea of that, but the way I see it is, yes, these things are inside me, but I don't think the universe or anything out there is there to receive them or to validate them. Mm. Where these things have validation is in the human community. And I think if my life does have a purpose, or if a human life has a purpose, it's to expand the circle in which those values can exist. We can expand it to other humans, so bring out their hope and their joy and give them things that make them hopeful and joy, that satisfy that hope and joy, create beautiful things for other people, and, you know, possibly also extend that to other creatures, animals, treat them with justice as well. To paraphrase, I think it's Saint Augustine, Lord, make me vegan, but not just yet.
Yeah. <It's>,
I had to do it because I love a bacon sandwich. Yeah. But that's where I see my purpose.
Yeah.
The universe, again, is not for me, but we're here. We have these values. Let's make this world the best world we can in order to experience these values.
I'll get you to come back on that in just a moment, Andy Kind, because we're going to go to a quick break. But yeah, I love the fact you're raising, you know, you're using the theologians that you've read already, Andy White, to open up this conversation, C.S. Lewis, Augustine and others. But we'll be back. We're talking about comedy, Christianity, Atheism, The Search for God on the show today. My guests are Andy Kind and Andy White. Andy Kind's new book is Hidden in Plain Sight, Clues You May Have Missed in the Search for Meaning. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Did you hear the one about the Christian and atheist who walked into a bar? Well, I have two stand-up comedians, a Christian and an atheist, joining me on the show today, Andy Kind and Andy White. And we're talking about Andy Kind's new book, Hidden in Plain Sight. And just in that last segment, Andy White was talking about the fact that, yes, some theologians and thinkers like Lewis have talked about this search for joy that sort of must correspond to some meaning that's out there, some bigger story, that, as you would put it, Andy. But Andy White says, well, maybe, you know, where we find that is actually in the human community, in what's in front of us, rather than somewhere out there in the universe. And that's his view as a humanist. So where do you go from there, Andy Kind?
Well, I think, and this is where it's lovely to have conversation rather than debate, isn't it? And, you know, I've been a subscriber to your show for a decade now, Justin, and it can sometimes sort of deteriorate. I think sometimes the problem for when met with a beautifully sort of expounded, you know, defense of humanism, as we've just had from Andy, I think the problem sometimes for the mistake that Christians make is to say, oh, but aren't you empty? Don't you feel empty? Or even worse, you are empty. You have this vacuum inside you. That's not my view at all. I think actually that, you know, we've all been through that long lockdown of the soul over the last couple of years. And whatever your worldview, it's perfectly possible to experience existential angst and loneliness and abandonment, and also equally possible to experience joy and hope and a sense for justice and love of your fellow man. And so I would say a great big yes to humanism. My view would be that the world needs more humanists, but humanists, you know, might look again at Jesus. I was listening to Andrew Copson and Alice Roberts talking, and I find this with a lot of humanists, both in my personal experience and on a wider sense, is that they're often humanists because of a rejection of sort of the monolithic religions and how they've had that presented to them. So the idea that you can't be good without God, or, you know, you're empty without God, or you'll be judged and sent to hell without God. And, you know, any of those may or may not be true. But again, the book Hidden in Plain Sight is based on the fact that we agree with these things. We agree that, you know, freedom is better than entrapment, and that love is a real thing. Love is the greatest power in the universe. And so when people like Andy are talking about humanism and what humanism can do. And it's about, you know, sending these little ripples out into the world. I'd say, you know, you're playing a wonderful tune, but where are you getting these instruments from? I think that's where I would go back to the idea that actually two things. I think humanism, I don't think you get humanism without 2000 years of the Judeo-Christian worldview. I don't think you get humanism as it's just been wonderfully described by Andy without standing on the bones of, you know, our Christian heritage, which is not to say that I'm a traditionalist or that we should, you know, just keep things, everything as they are. That's not what I'm saying at all. I also don't think you get humanism from a actually godless universe. I think absolutely we should expect humanism to have arisen because of a Christ-centered or a Christ-seat universe. And again, I would just say that I think these things are all good. Humanists are great people. Humanists are at least as nice as Christians. And so I'm not attacking humanists or even humanism, but simply to say, I think, and again, I used to listen to a lot of sort of American evangelicals who were very, again, great, but very didactic. And I've realized that I'm British and I want to be like C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton. I don't want it to be a boxing match. I like the idea that it's two wizards around a campfire smoking pipes. And so I would simply say my belief is that Christianity, the story of Jesus, makes more sense. I can leave it at that, be as gentle as that, makes more sense of the things that we've talked about, love and hope and justice, than the atheist worldview. And obviously humanism is a sort of standing on the scaffolding of atheism, if you like, as well as some other things. So I'd want to just put it as humbly and as modestly as that. I don't think it's possible to make any worldview completely cohere in the way that you'd want it to. And I have as many questions as answers about my own faith, my own theology. But I would say that the answers I think I do have stop me despairing about the remaining questions. And I just think we talked about Sehnsucht, that longing for something that you can't quite get to, whilst at the same time knowing that you long for it. I just think that's because, you know, in the beginning was the word. So creation is a creative act, it's spoken into existence. And, you know, we're made, according to the Christian worldview, we're made in the image of God. So we should expect to have the capacity for good. We should expect to recognize joy and hope. We should expect to believe that some things are not right, some things are objectively wrong. We should expect to want love to win. That there's only one fundamental worldview where love actually is said to win, and that's at the cross.
Andy, well, I'd be interested. There's lots to kind of respond to there, but
filibustering there, Justin.
That's all right. That's okay. You're a stand-up comedian. You know how to fill time. But the question, I suppose, the first question is. What do you make of Andy's contention there that humanism, in a sense, is standing on the foundation of 2,000 years of Judeo-Christian history in the first place?
Well, I'm trying to remember how you put it in your book, Hidden in Plain Sight, available from all good bookstores.
Yeah.
Giving you a little puff there. But you were saying about this catch-all spirituality based on various religious traditions and Star Wars quotes, etc. Yes. And my response to that was, yep, guilty as charged. When I think about where my values come from, yes, a lot of it will be built on the Judeo-Christian tradition. I was thinking particularly when you were talking about the emphasis on sort of the individual salvation, and in other traditions, you mentioned Hinduism and Buddhism, that's based on almost a denial of the importance of the individual. In Hinduism, the individual sort of goes back into, is it the Brahman? It's almost like a tentacle. The Atman is a tentacle of Brahman, and will fold back into that. And with Buddhism, the aim is to reach nirvana, which seems almost like a kind of oblivion, a detachment from everything.
Yeah.
And yes, that aspect of the Christian view is appealing to me, that individual life matters, individual experience matters, and the purpose of life is not to diminish those attachments, but to express them in a way that encourages yourself and everyone around you to flourish. So yes, I accept that. And I'm thinking here of Daniel Dennett. Familiar. Yeah, I've gone from theologians now to one of the four horsemen of atheism. But he talks about a religion being a sort of a nurse crop, because there are certain crops you grow alongside others in your allotment that overshadow and protect the crop you actually want to grow. And I think he uses the idea of, for instance, astronomy growing out of the religious study of the heavens. And yes, the morality of religion being a nurse crop that allowed human communities to flourish. And then what I would say is, I've sort of come to the conclusion that it actually makes more sense of the universe if I start from the assumption that there isn't a big God out there guiding everything for the good in some ultimate plan, but I've still inherited some values from the Christian tradition and other traditions I've been aware of. And now my job as a humanist is to salvage what I can from those and make them compatible with what I've come to know through science and science and experience. That's my view of it.
Great.
And love may not be the greatest power in the universe. We don't know. Gravity it seems to be the greatest power in the universe, because eventually, unless everything sort of expands and we get to the heat death of the universe, everything will collapse into one and the whole universe will end. But love is, for human beings, perhaps the most valuable thing, the thing that gives our life meaning.
Yeah.
And we've just got to give it our best try to love each other,
yeah,
and get through this and build a better world. It might not happen. We don't know what's going on. In the next 20 years, we could render ourselves extinct through our stupidity. But we have to hope, we have to try, and we have to love each other.
When you say we have to do those things, Andy, I suppose my first question is, well, why do we have to do those things? Maybe someone thinks, I don't have to do those things. I want to live a different way of life. But equally, I'm fascinated by, you know, you talk about the heat death of the universe. You know, do you see us as basically just a kind of random blip in the history of the universe? Humans come and go, and hey, you know, we had our short time in the sun, and that'll be it. Or is there, you don't see that we are literally, as you said, you know, in your opening, kind of a random, you know, sort of accident in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, Andy, you put us as a cosmic belch.
Yes,
in your book.
The lingering odor of a cosmic belch was the way that Andy Kine
which was suggested. in response to some of the sort of atheist, beautifully worded atheist scientists saying that, you know, we're stardust, which is great, it's poetic, but there's a more prosaic reality, which is that we're the lingering odor of a cosmic belch. Yeah.
Is that the way you see it, Andy White?
Yeah, because I was thinking about this after I read it. I'm thinking what my response to it would be. And I was thinking, well, first of all, we've got billions of years left, even if the universe does eventually collapse. We've got billions of years. And how do we want to spend those billions of years? We could either spend them moping about saying, oh, all of this is going to come to an end one day, or we could say to the universe, screw you, we're going to live our best lives.
Yeah.
And that's my attitude. We're going to live our best lives. And who knows what we could do in that billion years. We might eventually cohere into some universe, into some global consciousness. I think Teilhard de Chardin. I don't know if I've pronounced that right.
I know I've never the name.
He was a Catholic theologian, wasn't he? And he was talking about that's what the development of the human race will be in his own version of Christianity, that heaven is basically us coming together to form a global consciousness. I think it was, is it the noosphere or the noosphere?
Mm.
Come together like that. And I think there's a physicist, I think it's John Wheeler, I think, has talked about this to say perhaps at the end of the universe, of develop a technology that will enable us all, our consciousness, to be uploaded into it, and it can somehow cheat the heat death of the universe. I don't know. But even if we couldn't do those things, I was reminded of, and again, I get this from conversations I've had with Andy Kay, short stories. I think it's in the Illustrated Man, Bradbury story, where there's just some people having an ordinary, lovely day. I think they're having a barbecue, and then they start to, one man talks to his wife and says, did you have that dream last night? And he says, oh yeah, I've had that dream about the world's coming to an end. But midnight tonight, that's it. Everything's over. He says, yes. And everyone has had this dream, and everyone agrees just to, we'll just live, we'll just have a nice day. And it ends with the couple going to bed, and they softly say goodnight to each other, and that's it, the world ends. And I think if it all comes to an end, that would be a good way for us to approach it, or whatever our descendants are. Say, okay, it's coming to an end now, but let's go out gracefully.
Yeah. Of course, Ray Bradbury, that is from the Illustrated Man collection, and Ray Bradbury, whilst not an outright Christian, described himself as being at play in the fields of the Lord. And within that collection, there's also something called The Man, which is about this Messiah figure who appears on this foreign planet. The idea, I think, is based on Psalm 139, where can I go from your presence? If I go up into the heavens, you're there. So I don't know that Ray Bradbury was being particularly prescriptive in that, but simply perhaps satirizing it. And yes, I think, again, the orthopraxy of humanism is perfect. You know, if there is no God, then I don't know that humanism I heard it described as a brave way to live. I don't think humanism is brave. I think nihilism is brave and disastrous. But actually, nihilism follows logically from a godless universe. However, if I wasn't a Christian, I'd want to live as a humanist, because I think it's a great idea. I think it tells the first half. I think it tells the second half of a really good story. But I would just say, given all those things that you think are important and good, justice and hope, just not necessarily for you, Andy, but for humanists in general, I think, well, why don't you just have another look at Jesus? Why don't you sort of, you know, get rid of some of the rubble of religion and, you know, Christianity that you've been fed, and have a look again at the story of Jesus, who, and it says in the Bible, you know, the reason we love is because he first loved us. And I think that makes sense. And, you know, the last few years have been so hard for everybody. And I think what's interesting is that for Christians and non-Christians, a lot of our comfort has been stripped away. What I thought, you know, the joy of the Lord is my strength is a phrase that I've lived off for a long time. But what the pandemic showed me, that actually what I thought was the joy of the Lord was actually just Netflix and coffee. It was just some kind of, you know, self-administered adrenaline and placebo. And so my approach to apologetics and preaching has changed because I want it to be much more conversational. I don't try and command or demand anything of anybody. I wouldn't say you must live for Christ, you must believe this, but I would simply say Jesus still makes the best sense of the humanist story, of the human story, and he is real, and in his presence is fullness of joy. And I think it's that fullness thing that's really important. A lot of my humanist friends would mention the fact, oh, we've got to live for now. Well, that's perfectly biblical. John 10:10 says, you know, I've come to give you life in abundance, not eternal life in abundance, but life in abundance, life in its fullness, which starts now. And it's perfectly possible. Humanists are not empty people because they're humanists. They can experience joy and hope. And again, it's what the book says, like we agree on these things. My contention would simply be that if we want love in its fullness, joy in its fullness, hope in its fullness, freedom in its fullness at its, you know, end of level boss, then it's a relationship with Jesus that gets us that. You know, the great philosophers have wrestled with that. Kant said, we can never know the nature. We can never reach out and grab an objective reality. Well, what if objective reality reached in and grabbed us? And then Wittgenstein said, you know, truth is always going to be beyond the limits of human understanding, and truth is just a series of word games. Well, what if words became flesh and moved into the neighborhood to live amongst us? I just think that's it. It's Christianity is a really good story. I also happen to think that it's true. Even if it's not true, it's the best fiction out there. But I also think that it's experientially and emotionally true.
What do you think of that, Andy White?
We were saying, even if it's not true, it's the best fiction out there. I would say that the problem is with saying, oh, well, it's a good fiction, so let's go with it, let's live with it as if it's true, is that fiction, living by fictions, always at some point will bite you in the ass.
Mm.
You look at so like that Reverend Jim Jones, like, and the community he set up in Guyana. His fiction killed, I think up until 9/11, has killed the most Americans in one day or something. I'm sorry, I'm garbling it, but it was.
We know what you're saying.
Yes. So.
Let the record state I'm not claiming Christianity as a fiction, by the way. I don't want to lose my work.
Right.
I actually do believe it's true.
I guess, though, the point being, Andy White, is that Andy Kind is saying it's a story that he thinks makes sense of who we are, all these beliefs we have about hope, justice, joy, and so on. And even if you consider it a fictional story, it's a better story than the materialist story that here's the way Andy puts it in his book. I quite like this. He says, this is where the gigantic cosmic belch comes in. The grim prosaic reality is, and this is him describing a sort of an atheist worldview, that we are nothing more than the lingering odor from one gigantic cosmic belch. Love is not the greatest power in the universe. Freedom is a lie. Hope is a prank. Joy is an arbitrary accident of evolution. The doors in the wall of the world open out onto a gaping chasm of nothingness. And all that might be true, but at this point, you should want to resist it. So I guess, given that, yes, obviously, fictions can lead to some very dark places, I guess Andy Kind's point is that the story of materialism as a whole doesn't hold a candle, in his view, to the story of Christianity. What do you make of that contention in and of itself?
Okay. Well, what I would say is that, I look at this void that you talked about. I say, yeah, that void's there. And I turn away from the void back to my fellow human beings and say, yeah, we're in this void. Let's make the best of it. we have these values, and yes, they're human values, so they're perhaps only relevant to humans, a lot of them. I mean, no ant ever complained about, ever wanted civil rights.
Yeah.
That's just the way ants are. They live in the colony. That's what they do. So these things may just be relevant to us. And also, I would say, when I am approaching my values, I have a sort of always try to maintain an open-endedness to it, saying, right, this is what I believe provisionally, and I'm open to what new truths are brought in by reasons, what new truths are brought in by my experience, what truth is not available to me because I have illusions or bad thoughts at the moment. I was thinking, if you were to speak to me at 14 and say, Andy, what's your opinion on same-sex marriage? I know I would have said, oh no, this is weird. I said, has anyone thought of the children? Like that. Whereas now, I think I know gay people. Laws have been passed to have same-sex marriage, and I recognise that beforehand I was quite naive about this sort of thing, and my beliefs have adapted because I believe I've found a deeper version of the notion of human rights than I had before, that from which I've removed some of the excrescence of prejudice that I was brought up with. So it's always an ongoing thing. And I think sometimes with a belief system, it can be so closed off that it's not open to that sort of dialogue with other traditions, with other notions. So bring in another guy, Habermas, Jürgen Habermas. He talks about society developing through good faith dialogue. And so you don't censor people. Everyone talks on the same playing field. And yes, we never quite get to the objective truth because we're human and we're flawed and all that sort of thing. And it's always mediated by our senses and our ideas. But we can perhaps get closer to truth, or at least closer to a way of living that brings as many of us in as possible and provides the best life possible for as many of us. That's
Andy Kind.
Yeah, and again, I think yes and amen to all of that. I think I would say, so a couple of little things to think about for us. You've used a couple of times, you talked about how fiction is dangerous. And I agree with that fiction is ultimately dangerous if it's lived out as true. So what we want, both you and I and most people, is to have true beliefs. And I think, you know, the sort of the paradox of naturalism, if naturalism is true, then there's no reason to believe that it's true, because if there is no God, then our minds are not developed to get at truth. We're simply developed for survival. And again, Alice Roberts was talking about how humanism says that we should pursue love and, you know, rational thinking and empathy. Of course, I agree with these things. The problem is that reason isn't really a good account of a godless universe, because again, our minds are developed simply for survival and not to get at truth. So I would question this obsession that we all have with truth suggests that ultimately there is something true. And I think grounding truth in a personal being as God, again, just makes the most sense. If you don't get reason and truth from a godless universe, but you do get it from again, from the Judeo-Christian portrayal of the universe. And then I think the other thing is just about justice, because again, and you see it playing out now, we have an incredibly balkanized society where, and it's shifted over the previous generation. It used to be the case for Christian apologists like myself, relativism used to be the problem, moral relativism, where all truths were relative. If you see what's going on with the younger generation of social media, truth is not relative. Truth is absolutely fixed, but it's fixed in the heart of the individual. So we've got this bizarre, again, balkanization, tribalism, where truth simply becomes a survival of the retweetiest, a series of verbal spats. It's not simply that my truth is that and your truth is that, but my truth is true. And if you don't agree with it, you're a bigot. And I think we have this problem. If there is no fixed grounding of truth and objectivity, we don't lose that sense of justice, which again, I think comes from being made in the image of God. We all have this sense of justice. I mean, Putin has a real defined sense of justice. We would say that he's absolutely objectively wrong to be doing what he's doing. But if there is no, again, if there is no ultimate truth, then we can't really say that what he's doing is wrong. We could just try and outshout him or outmaneuver him. And so, again, I think humanism is great. I think but it just seems to me that it's Christianity's kit with the badge ripped off. And I would just say, well, you don't need to worry too much about creating a system where human beings treat each other well and work for human flourishing. There already is one, and it actually has a wonderful personal relationship at the center of that with a person who is love and is light and is life. So again, I think it's just a better story. It's not right as opposed to wrong. It's better.
We're going to go to a quick break and then we'll have a final sort of 10 minutes or so to conclude thoughts on this. But we're talking at a deep level. I mean, we've had Kant and Wittgenstein and Habermas and all sorts of clever names brought up. Yeah. So don't go thinking that, stand-up comedians can't, debate it with the best of them. It's been a lot of fun. Andy Kind and Andy White joining me on today's edition of Unbelievable. And we'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back. We're talking about comedy and Christianity on the show today, and we'll be bringing you the final part of the discussion in a moment. Some of your feedback still to come as well. We've had some interesting responses to last week's show between Michael Gunger and Evan Wickham on millennials, music and mystical deconstruction. Still to come here on Premier Christian Radio tonight on The Profile, Anthony Ray Hinton is an American activist, writer and author who was wrongly convicted of the 1985 murders of two fast food restaurant managers in Birmingham, Alabama. Well, Hinton was sentenced to death and held on the state's death row for 28 years before his release in 2015. You can hear his extraordinary story and how his faith has sustained him and now drives his ministry work. That's with Sam Hales on The Profile tonight at 8 p.m. Coming up next week here on Unbelievable, can Christianity or humanism save the planet from climate change? As COP27 takes place in Egypt, the future of climate change and biodiversity continue to be a major concern. Now, both people with and without faith are involved in the fight, but does atheism or Christianity provide a better foundation for engaging in climate action? Well, Christian climate campaigner Rachel Mander will join me, along with humanist climate action coordinator Laurie Marriott, discussing what motivates them to make a difference for the planet and engaging with each other. So that's next week's Unbelievable show. And just a quick reminder before we go back into today's discussion, Culture War Questions with Sean McDowell. That's what we're doing for our live event on Tuesday, the 15th of November. Come and ask your questions. It's an audience Q&A show, free online event. Just register at unbelievable.live. The link is with today's program. So we've been talking about Andy Kind's new book on the show today. It's called Hidden in Plain Sight, Clues You May Have Missed in the Search for Meaning. Andy is a stand-up comedian. So is Andy White, who's been joining us as well. Andy White is a humanist. And we've sort of been going back and forth on why as far as Andy Kind is concerned, Christianity kind of tells a better story of reality. And he says atheists, humanists should look into it. In fact, rather cheekily there, said Andy White, humanism is just Christianity with the badge ripped off. what's your view on all this then? Because obviously you get along well with Andy Kind. I'm sure you get along well with people of faith as well, generally. And Andy Kind has kind of been saying, well, maybe you should look a bit closer at Jesus, at this story that he thinks kind of explains the story that you're living, the humanist story, to some extent. Andy White, do you just think don't need it? I mean, what's your reaction to that kind of invitation?
Well, looking, say, more broadly at the biblical story, I look at what astronomy, cosmology says about the development of the universe, and then I look at Genesis and I go, no, that's not true. That doesn't seem to me to be true. Okay, some people interpret it metaphorically or whatever, but I'm just looking at, no, the picture that makes most sense of the physical universe seems to come from science. So whatever it is, however I want to live my life, it should be in accord with that. When my son was born, I was born under difficult circumstances, and we had a Buddhist naming ceremony for him, for my wife and her friends. And there was one lady there talking about, disparagingly about scientific materialism. And I didn't say at the time, but I was thinking, because of scientific materialism, my son is alive. Mm. Again, very difficult birth, C-section. His head was being pressed against the fibroid inside my wife, and this was pressing on a nerve which stopped his heart. If there hadn't been, we hadn't been in the hospital ward, and the hospital ward hadn't been just next to a surgery, into a theatre, and there'd been this swarm of medical ninjas around her, I wouldn't, 10 minutes later, be holding my son in my arms. So, yes, there is definitely a role for scientific materialism that serves human values. And also, yes, to say that there is an objective reality out there, and Jesus Christ is the avatar of it, for want of a better term at the moment. Again, that's just an assertion. What I think is that, whatever it is we're developing may not be directly approaching objective reality, but from sort of a pragmatic point of view, it provides models of reality that work. There was a scientific model of reality that saved my son. Mm. And I don't think that it would have been saved, his life would have been saved by thoughts and prayers. There's always that thing after a shooting at a high school in the States, there's a politician will stand up and say, thoughts and prayers. We send our thoughts and prayers. And everybody goes, no, you don't need thoughts and prayers. You need to have a rational approach to your gun control laws. Mm. That's what you need. So I think that, so again, I would say that the Jesus story is, again, it's just an assertion. It's been a very successful assertion, I think. There might be things in it that people have found appealing and plausible, but also it's at one stage had the Roman Empire and then various European empires behind it that probably helped as well. So I would, to bring in another fourth horseman, Richard Dawkins. Even in his God Delusion book, he says that the idea of God is almost certainly untrue. It's almost certainly untrue. He's not that dogmatic about it. It just says, with science, with the scientific rational point of view, we develop ideas, we change ideas, in the face of new evidence. But theories can never ultimately be proved. They can only be falsified. Karl Popper, great guy. So with any theory, we can only ever say, well, it might be true, it might not. But on balance of probabilities, given the hypotheses that have been presented about the nature of God, it's probably untrue. And I would say it's probably untrue. So my best bet is to live my life as if it isn't true. And again, to find the best life possible for myself and those I love within that. Yes, there are things I could take from Jesus. I love that business about looking after the poor and approaching people, peace and love and all that sort of, that is lovely. But I don't believe that that story or that person who was the historical Jesus was the Son of God. And from what I've seen of the universe and how it behaves, it doesn't seem to me that there is a God out there who loves us all, who wants the best for us all. The way the universe, the way the natural world works, it's in many ways a vicious thing. Vicious called coronavirus. We've been trapped in our houses because of this natural event. And yay, science, we've now got a vaccine for it. So that's just one example.
Well, yeah. I mean, we're approaching the end of the show now. So Andy, you might want to start to sort of both respond to that, to what Andy White had to say there, and start to kind of, you know, as we draw the show to a close, kind of give your final thoughts as we do so.
Yeah, thank you. And it's been a real joy. And what I've loved is that it's completely non-adversarial. You know, Andy is my friend, and it's been great to just, again, two wizards smoking pipes. So I just make some observations rather than wanting to be in any way sort of aggressive about it. And in terms of the natural world, in terms of the scientific arguments, my belief is that the arguments for theism are slightly better than the arguments for atheism. But I don't try and prove or persuade people of the truth of Christianity based on scientific arguments. I thought what you said was really interesting. You talked about how, you know, the natural world is really vicious, and that is true. If there is no God, we are simply part of the natural world. So who are we to step outside of it and to say, look, this is vicious and also wrong? I think, you know, David Hume talked about the problem of the ought, didn't he? There's a way that we believe we should live. We know that some things are objectively wrong. And this takes me back exactly to the reason for writing Hidden in Plain Sight. I'm not trying to persuade people on the basis of how the cosmos operates. I'm not trying to persuade people based on how Christians operate, or even based on the historical Jesus. Again, I think the arguments for that are slightly better than the alternatives. But I wasn't, you know, you said the Jesus story is an assertion. I'm not actually asserting that. The book is inductive reasoning. So it starts with what we know, with the specific things that we know. We want to be loved. We know that justice is a real thing. That's really come out, that we have this heart for justice and right and wrong. We want love to win. We want people to be free. We want goodness to rise. So that, you know, that's not an assertion, that's an agreement. And then the reality is, whether it's true or not, the Jesus story really does fit with our desires. And we can still say, oh, I don't believe in the historical Jesus. But then that just takes us back to the start. Okay, well, what do we do with this? And humanism is a nice idea, but it's been a nice idea for a long time, and it hasn't stopped lots of bad things from happening. So George Orwell said, if you want to have a vision of the future, imagine a boot trampling on a human face forever. And the problem we see going on with Russia and Ukraine is not that humanism hasn't reached Russia, or even that the gospel hasn't reached Russia. is that people do what they want to do. People act according to their own desires, and no amount of, you know, fangling and sort of poetic admonishments is going to stop people from doing that. In that situation, we do need a bigger story that ultimately will bring some sort of justice and goodness and wipe every tear. And so I think I'd end on this, is that the great thing about the gospel, you know, the good news of Jesus, and I don't think it's enough for it to be true. I think it has to be good news. And this is why it's good news, is because the gospel says that you're not as good as you want to be. You're not as good as these sort of abstract concepts of what we might be as a species somewhere down the line. You're never going to be that. But nor are you written off and condemned. You are flawed but adored. And that's where I'd end. That's the gospel for me, is that regardless of what else is true, we are flawed but adored. And there really is a person that we can go to experience joy and hope in its fullness. These things, of course, exist because God's not in a box in a corner. But if we really want to see these things in their fullness, justice in its fullness, there is a place to go.
Final thoughts from you, Andy White?
Right. Yes. I suppose it boils down to that I don't think there is anything outside us, as I said at the start, that validates justice. There is nothing that will guarantee that it will win in the end, which makes me more determined to try to do what I can in this life to make those things happen. And I would like to say, this has been a great conversation. Thank you both for having me talk through this. And maybe for conciliatory, I think going forward with regard to making the world a better place, where we can agree on values and ways forward for making this world better, I'm happy to work with anyone of any faith or none to bring that about.
There you go. I'll expect to see you both on the same stage at some point then, you know,
you
with the Andy and Andy tour coming to a town near you. No, seriously, great conversation. Thank you, Andy White, for being willing to step in and have this discussion with Andy Kind. And there will be links to the book from today's show and to both of you. You can find Andy White over on Twitter as well, at Andy J. White, andykind.co.uk for Andy's website. And we'll make sure there's a link to the book as well. But it's been a great conversation. Thank you very much. Hope we can do it again at some point in the future.
Thank you.
Look forward to hearing what you made of today's programme. You can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can share your thoughts via our social media sites at UnbelievableFE for our Twitter account, facebook.com/PremierUnbelievable if you want to interact with us on Facebook. You can find all of those links at our YouTube channel as well, and much more besides, at premierunbelievable.com. We've had some great articles in the past week over at the website, by the way, including the full transcript of the Michael Gunga and Evan Wickham discussion. So you might want to check that out if you want to read through it in full. And we've got some of your thoughts on it coming up in just a moment's time. Loads of great podcasts as well coming out in the past week. Ask NT Wright Anything on What Did St. Paul Believe About Justification, Election and Salvation. The Matters of Life and Death guys have been talking about Protestant social teaching, chronological snobbery, rejecting one-size-fits-all ethics and worldly versus spiritual matters. Always a great conversation between John and Tim Wyatt. On the C.S. Lewis podcast, Ruth Jackson has been sitting down with Trevin Wax to talk about Lewis. Trevin is over for a special C.S. Lewis conference. And on Unapologetic, continuing her conversation with Claire Williams, this time on why racial justice matters. So if you want to check out the podcasts, premierunbelievable.com is the place to do it. Just a reminder that the London Unbelievable Skeptic Discussion Group relaunches as well this coming Monday, the 7th of November. So if you want to be part of that, they'll be meeting at the Cock Tavern, 23 Phoenix Road, between King's Cross and Euston Station. Kicking off with a talk, Does God Have a Body or Did the Hebrews Think So? Andrew White, an ex-Christian, has researched this one, will be doing the talk. But it's a welcome place for both Christians and non-Christians to come and discuss those kinds of issues. And just one final mention that the CARE Leadership Programme, I was with the CARE graduates not long ago at their London base. Well, the deadline is approaching, the 18th of November. If you want to, or if you know someone who would like to be part of a unique year-long programme that gives new graduates the opportunity to work for a parliamentarian or with an NGO for 4 days a week and running an intensive study programme for 1 day a week, as well as termly residentials. Theology, political theory, ethics and leadership skills are all covered. It's a really amazing one-year programme for young, bright graduates who might want to be interested in that. Applications, as I say, close on 18th of November, care.org.uk if you know someone who'd be interested in that. Okay, let's go to some of your feedback to recent editions of the show. And as I said earlier, lots of response actually to last week's show. This was on millennials, music and deconstruction with Michael Gunger and Evan Wickham. Michael Gunger, of course, has a story of being a pioneer in the Christian music scene, but his faith changing quite radically to becoming a very sort of deconstructed, quite esoteric, sort of Eastern influenced sort of perspective now. And he was in conversation with Evan Wickham, who's a pastor in San Diego, but takes an Orthodox Christian perspective on these things. We may be up for a round two, both of those guys, so maybe look out for that in the new year. But this one from Zeke said, I love to hear these stories from those within the evangelical camp struggling with their faith. It's very enlightening. Here's a common thread from these deconstruction stories that I've picked up on that both Michael and Evan mentioned. Just an observation at this point. I suspect there may be more at work. Almost without exception, they have been raised with young earth creationism as their view of origins. This secondary issue rises to become a primary issue, which is non-negotiable in many evangelical churches. As discussed in this episode, healthy churches allow full-orbed discussions and doubts on any topic. Keep up the great work. Thank you, Zeke. Phil Batterson, I read an email from Phil ahead of the program airing last week. This is what he wanted to say now that he's heard the show. Says, still feeling wounded by Michael's choice, but previously I was a little defensive because of the apostasy issue. I was concerned that he would take the stance of, well, I don't hate Christians or Christ, and he did. But I think you had the right guest on, an old friend in Evan Wickham who landed in a different place after deconstruction, who showed true empathy and a desire to reach his friend. You see, I have a friend who came to Christ with me. We have very similar conversion stories, but he fell away and quote unquote gained greater understanding, as though Christ was like the novice level understanding of the greater wisdom of the universe. And that was heartbreaking for me. In a lot of ways, I failed him. I just can't be enough to bring him back. It's like that scene from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Harrison Ford holding that girl's hand and she tells him, I can almost reach it, referring to the Holy Grail. And as a result of her greed and desire, Ford loses his grip on her and she falls into the abyss. At the end of the day, though, Michael is on his own path. We know God is calling him, and right now Michael perhaps isn't hearing it, or we aren't seeing God's miracle as it unfolds. But anyway, thank you very much. Good to hear from you, Phil. Obviously it can be very emotionally difficult when people go through big changes of the kind Michael Gunger has been through, and obviously your friend has been through. Thanks for sharing. Sam Otto gets in touch. Been listening to Unbelievable for roughly 3 years now. This is the first time writing. I'm doing so in reference to Gunga and Evan Wickham. During this, Michael made the assertion that Orthodox Christianity has drastically reimagined the words they use from what Jesus would actually have meant. Evan, in turn, asked Michael what his grounding for that assertion was. Michael's reply was essentially his own personal experience, in particular his 2016 spiritual trip, which he openly acknowledged could be wrong. This is in contrast to Evan, who bases his understanding on the words of Jesus in the context of community and history. Using personal experiences as a justification for leaving the faith or reinterpreting scripture was a common sentiment among former Christian artists that you've had on your show, John Steingard and Audrey Assad, in addition to Michael Gunger. Essentially, they seem to leave the faith because their personal experiences are producing a different truth that they feel is correct. This line of thinking is dangerous, as all personal experiences are very different and will ultimately lead to all kinds of different truths as opposed to the actual truth. I understand people like Bart Ehrman who walk away from the faith because of valid historical and intellectual reasoning. However, to walk away from the faith because of personal feelings is a very individualistic and unsound way of looking at the world. I think people, in particular former Christian music artists, need to be more community-oriented in seeking after truths, as Proverbs 11:14 says, "In an abundance of counsellors there is safety." Thank you, Sam, for that perspective. Jeffrey Jones wanted to say, after listening to today's episode, I still have no idea how Reverend Wickham defines orthodoxy or how he's determined what constitutes historic Christian orthodoxy. What is orthodoxy and who gets to define it? I wish that had gotten cleared up at the start of the episode. Thanks, Jeffrey. And Russell Edwards, who wasn't very keen on this show, says, "Ugh," is the start of his email. "I'm sorry, Justin, but I tapped out of this one after giving it a go for 20 minutes. Identify as was a red flag for me, but the reference to, quote unquote, your truth was where I had to yank the earphone plug out of the phone. It troubles me that you have serious philosophers and theologians on your show, but then people who spout such nonsense without any challenge. I'm a new Christian, the kind of choose your own adventure, fabricate your own God that conforms to the world. New Age syncretism is what I turned away from in following Jesus. I don't know why I'd want to hear from people taking the reverse journey. Perhaps there is value in hearing it with an alert, critical ear. But normally I turn your program on in the hope of hearing people articulate that critical thinking at a superior level than I'm likely to come up with myself. I had to unplug because it seemed almost inevitable that one of them was going to stoop to saying the really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus. I'm ready to accept him as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. Sorry to be negative. I do love the show generally," says Russell. Well, Russell, in fairness, you know, if you had listened beyond 20 minutes, I think you would have heard Evan doing exactly that, you know, challenging Michael with the sort of the orthodox claims of Christianity. Inevitably, whenever you have a conversation like this, you have to hear someone's story, someone's perspective. That's what Unbelievable always does. And even if you disagree with it, you know, as you obviously do with Michael Gunga's perspective, we need to be, you know, aware of the points of view people have and be able to engage with them in hopefully in a critical but friendly way. But I appreciate that, you know, not every conversation will appeal to everyone. But thanks for writing in. Good to hear from you. And one final one here from Brian Cooper. A bit of a long one, this, but I think I'll try and read the whole of this out. Brian from Waukesha, Wisconsin, reaching out, says, "Apologies for the length. Thanks for continuing to foster excellent dialogues on important issues. Really enjoyed the conversation between Michael and Evan. I, like many, have been a longtime fan of Michael Gunga's music and followed parts of his journey. Evan, I wasn't familiar with until this episode, but I enjoyed their friendly and open dialogue that sought understanding. Something I consider essential to forming understanding is a pressing in on statements that feel inadequate and illogical in how they're presented. This isn't to win, per se, but it is an important aspect of understanding. So with this in mind, did I ask the following observations? Firstly, throughout the conversation, both Michael, Evan, and I believe you at one point, Justin, referred to God as a what rather than a who. I found myself doing this from time to time as well, because probably like most people interested in the intellectual side of theology, the tendency is to turn God into an abstract concept that we're trying to wrap our minds around rather than the being beyond our finite comprehension who has authored all things. This framing of God as an object seemed to form a lot of the conversation into a personal understanding or conclusion that each person has to come to on their own, rather than a living and active God who is present in revealing himself. In my experience, this tends to be a major facet to the modernist and postmodernist conundrum when it comes to organized religion. There's a lot to be said on this, but I don't want to monopolize your time, and I want to make the observation, possibly a future conversation for an episode, on the whatness of God versus the person of God. But secondly, this response may seem pointed, and I'm sorry for that, but my goal again is to drive at something honest and truthful. I really struggled with Michael presenting his position as one of humbling himself or opening himself to a greater sense of what is possible. I think I've had a high dose of interactions with people who have had similar experiences to the 2016 experience Michael described, and this is often referred to as a death of ego. Only everyone that describes the aftermath of this seems to think they've had some type of special revelation for how the world is, and others are simply living behind the veil. In part, I agree with this. I think there is a great tradition of Christian thinkers who point to this sense of our living within the shadowlands. The Desert Fathers come to mind, as do Chesterton, Williams, and C.S. Lewis. One of the best examples of this is, in a modern and secular context that I can think of, is David Foster Wallace's commencement speech, specifically the joke about water as an observation of how we're oblivious oblivious to what we're swimming in. Again, we may briefly touch on this here in different ways, but I think the general approach that Michael and other expressions of this belief have isn't actually humble, but rather arrogant, because it takes the ability to define what is into his or their own hands, rather than the humble submission to something outside and beyond, something like orthodox creeds in the Christian tradition, which surrender the individual's ability to define and shape things in our own image and rely on God's shaping of reality in his image. As a person who struggles with authority and authority figures, I also get the desire to kick against this, but would also point to why God's revelation is viewed as wisdom literature rather than prescriptive law-giving. Again, this is a long topic to elaborate on and nuance out, but this comes full circle to that original conundrum presented in Genesis. Who has the authority to give shape to the moral constructs of the world, God or us? And Michael seems to say that it is us. And thirdly, this is not some new concept, and just like the American church, is rooted in a distinctly American offshoot of Romanticism, Transcendentalism. Again, I don't want to dismiss this simply by grounding it in a traditional belief system, but I do think it's important to acknowledge that this is not new and or a novel approach and critique to the church, but has historical and human roots from which it evolved. And fourth, and finally, I know very long you say, but this last point will be brief. Language is limited, but narrative is expansive. The postmodern dismissal of communication due to the challenges of language and solipsism always feel like a cop-out. Language is limited, but it also gives unprecedented access to the other in the shape of narrative, which requires reflection, meditation and questioning to find what is helpful, good and useful. Books such as Wittgenstein's Mistress do a fantastic job in critiquing this notion of language limitations by drawing out the logical manifestation of what would happen if we took this concept seriously, rather than picking and choosing convenient moments to deploy this, like in critiquing religious systems with holy texts. Anyway, end of rant. Thank you, Justin. I feel like each of these points could use so much more fleshing out and some solid challenging counterpoints to get further along than I was able to in such a brief space. Grateful for all you do. Thanks, Brian. Very thoughtful response there from everyone who got in touch about that show. So thanks for that. And we'll get more of your responses in future weeks as well. But for now, we're out of time. Thank you for being with us on the show today. Be interested in hearing your responses as well to our two Andys, our two comedians discussion today, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you want more commentary and really interesting apologetic content, check out some of the articles coming out regularly now over at premierunbelievable.com. And while you're there, you could click through to our Sean McDowell Culture War Questions live event, Tuesday the 15th of November. Would love to see you there as part of it. It's free to attend from anywhere in the world. You just need to register at unbelievable.live. For now, thanks for being with us, and let me tell you what's coming up next time. Can Christianity or humanism save the planet from climate change? With COP27 getting underway in Egypt, the future of climate change and biodiversity continues to be a major concern. Both people with and without faith are involved in the fight, but does atheism or Christianity provide a better foundation for engaging in climate action? Well, Christian climate campaigner Rachel Mander will join me, along with humanist climate action coordinator Laurie Marriott. They're discussing what motivates them in engaging with each other on the show next week. Thanks for being with me for now. See you next time.